All right, Wildlings, you wanted the best. You got the best, the hottest podcast out of the Louisville metro area, Sean versus Wild. I'm your host, the man, the myth, the Sean Thriller Smith, the guy putting rad back into talk radio. And it's time to rock and roll all night and podcast every Tuesday. On the show today, been wanting to have a member or two of this band on for so long. So lucky to have Brian Whiteman from Emmanuel join me in the studio for a special two-part episode. Part one's today. Part two is going to come out on Friday, but the magic of podcasts is you can just listen to it whenever you want, but be aware of that. The next one will come out on Friday. In the past, I've had like 7 days in between. I put one out on Tuesday, one out on Thursday. This one's Friday. I think Friday's going to be the big day. I got a great feeling about it, guys. So make sure you check out part two. But Emmanuel is one of the most influential bands on my career, one of the most influential bands on a lot of people's music in this area. So very happy to have him on. Very glad that he could join me. Part one, we're going to be talking about the origin of Emmanuel, how they started their days in Emmanuel Nice, their first albums. And then part one's going to end basically around the time that they recorded and released Soundtrack to a Head Rush. We're going to pick up from there in part two, going into Black Earth Tiger and the eventual end of the band. So, yeah, and this podcast will coincide with actually the 10-year anniversary of Black Earth Tiger. I cannot believe that it's been a decade already. So definitely going to want to listen to both parts. A lot of great stories. Thank you, Brian, for being on the show. Also, guys, not going to lie to you, at the time of this recording, it's late. It's late at night. I actually just got back from a show, went and saw Quick Runner, Darlington Pairs, and Midnight Channels at Z Bar and Zanzibar. If you haven't been, venue's great, and the bands were fantastic. Quick Runner did a podcast with us back in March. If you haven't checked that out, make sure you do so. Also, something tells me Darlington Pairs will be on the show maybe here in a few weeks. What do you think about that? So you're going to definitely want to check out those guys. And while you're checking stuff out, check out my sponsor at audiophileinc.com. I'm talking about Shane at Audiophile Inc., and he's going to give you the best deal in town no matter what town you live in, because this guy is screen printing on whatever you want, on the brands that you want, your band, your cause, your business, whatever. He's going to slap that thing on a t-shirt or tank top or whatever you want, and he's going to make you look like $1 million, giving you the best deal in town no matter what town you live in. He ships to all 50 nifty United States. So definitely make sure, if you're in a band, hey, all the dudes in Emmanuel got their stuff printed from Shane years ago. So if you still got your old Emmanuel t-shirts, yeah, they still probably look like $1 million. And that's because Shane did them years and years ago, and they still look good. That's the high quality stuff that I'm talking about there. Check out Shane, audiophileinc.com, AudiophileInc.com. Tell them the Wild Man sent you and get a great deal on stuff. Also, guys, going back to that concert, if you happen to have seen me at the show, I called it a concert, whatever. If you saw me at the show, you saw me wearing my Sean versus Wild t-shirt. You saw me passing out flyers. If you were one of these people that gave the show a chance because I gave you a flyer, thank you so much for tuning in. Hopefully this is a great first episode for you, a great jumping off point, and hopefully you'll go back and listen to the old ones, and you'll be a faithful listener to the new ones. But yeah, and everybody else that's been with me through thick and thin, thank you so much. Of course, the show's on iTunes. It's on Stitcher. It's wherever you get your podcast. You love it. You know it already. If you like it, tell a friend. If you hate it, thanks for still listening. I definitely appreciate it. Tell somebody you hate, and then you can just laugh because they just listen to a podcast that sucks. I don't know. I don't know what else to say, guys. But you know what? It's time. Enough from me. You know what time it is. It's time to put your best shoes on, grow your hair out long, and tell your sister she's a... Well, you know the rest. Hey, man, let's get wild. Yeah, I think the big question on everyone's mind is, did you catch the eclipse yesterday?
I did. I was real excited to get out there and watch it with my dog. From the yard, I had glasses, he didn't, and he was unimpressed, to say the least.
Were you impressed? I don't know, man. Like, it's so funny because it's like a natural phenomenon. It's like we're watching a miracle, and then when I looked at it, I was like, huh. Just kind of looked like the moon at night.
Yeah, I was amazed by what the difference between 100% totality, the path of totality, which I think is a good cave-in record title. and what 96% was. And I'm just like, okay, it's a little dark, but I feel like 4% of the sun is completely adequate. In fact, in the summertime around here, I'd prefer it.
Yeah, I wish we were always kind of at about a 96% totality. Not always, but, you know, during the day. It cooled off, kind of felt nice. But I see everybody on Facebook, they're like, dude, 100% totality. And I'm like, this is the first time maybe in your life that you use that word. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I could see that. The thing for me with it was, I don't know, like, the cooling off was cool. The looking at houses next to mine was more impressive than looking at the eclipse to me. And I've heard a lot of people be like, oh, don't be such a dick about it.
Yeah, dude, this is a natural phenomenon. Can you believe this?
Yeah, but I just thought it would do way more with 96%. But also in that 96%, I think I came up with an idea to save the world.
Which is?
To at least combat global warming. And that's going to be, we're going to have to build a Death Star type moon.
Mm-hmm.
That, I guess like a drone, probably operate it like a drone.
I'm sure NASA could come up with something like this.
And you just manipulate it to block off 96% of the sun, you know, 20 days a year over the ice caps, whatever.
Yeah. Perfect, man.
Crisis averted.
Well, NASA, if you're listening, there's an idea for you.
Gonna need to. How do you get paid for that?
I don't know. But guys, if you're listening, this isn't the Sean versus the Eclipse podcast. You'll never believe it. This is the Sean versus Wild podcast. And here at the Smithsonian with me today, I've got Brian Whiteman, the bad boy of fishing and bass player for, if I may say, Louisville's most influential band, Emmanuel.
That's nice of you to say, Sean.
I think that's the case. And if you listen to some of these back podcasts, which I know you'll be all over these, as soon as you get home, you'll be listening to all of them. But I've made that reference before, and a lot of people that have been on the show have made that reference before. They're like, Emmanuel is the band that influenced me. And that sound, the Emmanuel sound, still resonates in local bands today, whether it was with my old band, Uh-Huh Baby Yeah, or with it's like a heavier band like Foxbat. You can hear the Emmanuel sound in the Louisville bands, in the Louisville culture.
What kind of riff-raff are you having on this show?
Yeah, that's true. But yeah, I mean, it was very influential. Emmanuel's an absolutely influential band for me, for a lot of us out there. And I'm just glad that you decided to come over here and join me to talk about the origin to the end. We were working on it, guys, off camera. You didn't, or off mic, whatever. We were trying so hard to come up with cool names for the beginning and the end.
Thesaurus.
Yeah. For the alpha and the omega of Emmanuel.
Yeah. Well, one thing I was thinking about, Sean, is I don't think that the last time I did an interview regarding Emmanuel, there was such a thing as a podcast.
Yeah, probably not.
So I don't know where to look. Where's the camera?
Right. It's such a visual medium. Well, there's one on me, there's one on you, and then there's a two-shot.
Two-shot.
You know what I'm talking about.
Yeah,
of course. Two-shot. Shout out to Rick Neumeier, WJHS, telecommunications.
Taught us everything we know.
Everything we know. But let's go ahead and just dive right into the meat and the potatoes, if you will,
mm-hmm.
of Emmanuel. How did you guys start? How did you guys know each other?
Oh, so Matt Breen and myself lived in the same neighborhood, and he was in a neighborhood band with some other dudes. I had never played an instrument in my life at that point, and I really wanted to get into it. But my parents were like, they didn't want to buy me. I was probably 13 at that time. And at some point, I finally conned my parents into not buying me a bass guitar for Christmas, but renting one for me.
From Doo-Wop Shop?
From Doo-Wop Shop.
That's the best place to rent if you're trying to rent something.
And the deal was, if I stuck with it, I think they were going to buy me one. And I think, so Matt and I started a band called Dumb Luck with these other two dudes.
With Zach Howard.
That's right, yeah.
I know Zach Howard. I went to high school with him.
Yeah.
He was always like, dude, I was in Emmanuel briefly. Well, we were called Dumb Luck. He doesn't sound anything like that. That's just my voice when I do other people's
You should get
voices.
Him on the show.
I would love to. Like, tell me about your time in Dumb Luck.
That should be an interesting story. I think we had two band practices, played one show, and then Matt and I decided we were too serious for Ty and Zach, and we had to get out and start a different thing because we were, at age 14, we're very committed to the band.
That's
so
true.
I knew that I'd played soccer with Anthony when I was younger, and I knew he played drums. So found him one day, I think at like Kentucky Kingdom or something like that, brought it up, and he's like, yeah, I'll do it, but we got to bring this dude Matt Barber in too. So that was the...
That was the agreement.
The origin.
That was the treaty that we had signed. Yeah. And from that day, you are Emmanuel Nice. What's the origin of... Speaking of origin, how did the name Emmanuel Nice come about? Because I've heard a lot of fake stories.
I don't even know the real story anymore because we've lied about it for so long. I really don't know. It's really one of the worst fucking band names of all time.
It's not terrible.
And it cursed us all the way through. The fact, let's change our band name, but everything sounded... Because by the time we shortened it, we had been a band for six years, I think. We were...
Yeah.
19 or 20, we had been a band for 5 or 6 years, and it felt weird to like just change the name, although we definitely should have. I don't know the original story.
I was trying to get a hot tip. I was trying to get like an exclusive story here, guys.
I think I know, but it's so embarrassing that I'm not going to tell
Ahead and just tell it.
No, bro. I'm not going to tell it. It's
you know
stupid.
What I'm saying? Is it about Manuel being nice? Because I've heard about that one.
No.
Also, I heard about somebody like screaming religious references in the middle of a party or something.
No, that's not
many
it.
Many of these lied stories. Something that you guys came up with it on the Ferris wheel at Kentucky Kingdom.
Yeah, I don't think so. I think Breen came up with it, and I was just like, okay, that's cool with me. I don't really care. Let's just play some songs.
That was a great name for the time, though. I feel like Emmanuel Nice.
For a 14-year-old pop punk band, I think it worked.
A 14-year-old pop punk band, circa 2003, 2004, and before that. I mean, that was cool. I mean, that's just as cool as like, Recover or something like that, you know?
Yeah.
It seems like it just fit right in.
I think Recover was called Recover when they were 14, though. I think they beat us on that one, but...
This has a little bit of originality because now I see new bands and they're like, what's your band called? And it's like, we're called Airplanes or something like that.
Yeah.
And it's like, certainly there was another band that had this name.
Yeah.
Yes, but the A is upside down. You see, it's a V. Oh, I gotcha.
Yeah.
It's an upside down triangle. Nailed it.
Well, you got to go symbols at some point because, you know, you can only use those letters so many times.
That's so true. So, okay, Dumb Luck. Mm-hmm. Turns into Emmanuel Nice.
Right.
By handshake agreement in Kentucky Kingdom.
Yes.
And where does it go from there?
I believe band practice number one took place.
We'll start from the very beginning.
Yeah,
Band practice number one went a little something like this.
I remember all 7,323 band practices.
I have them recorded and cataloged VHS tapes.
I have
and
a journal. So practice one, I've got details from every single one of them, but
you're going to love this.
This was in my parents' garage. This Matt Barber had not shown up yet. So it's Anthony, Breen, and I in my parents' garage, which is the first and only time we ever practiced in my parents' garage. That was it. And I don't remember what we did. We played some songs, I guess, probably like a cover of some type. And then we transported our gear to Anthony's mom's, where we remained for a couple years, I think. The first practice we ever had at Anthony's mom's, the police came, which set kind of the tone for the next 10 years of the band.
You guys are just too darn loud.
Yeah. Yeah. We were loud even then with combo amps, single 10 combo amps. We managed to get the cops called.
Hey, man, those crates can really crank. But that actually leads me, though, you kind of touched on this earlier. You're like, hey, we decided we were way too serious to continue on with Dumb Luck. But I will say the one thing that I took notice of when I first heard of Emmanuel Nice, which was probably, I don't know, 2002, 2003. I remember somebody handed me a flyer and you guys played at, what was that venue that was in the quadrangle?
There were two. There was the Soundstick, which was the first one. And then there was the 540, which was like the punk rock club.
Yeah. So I believe you guys, like, I got a flyer that said Emmanuel Nice was going to be at, you know, the 540.
Couldn't have been 2003, though. It would have been... That place got shut down in, like, 2000, 2001, I think. I don't think we were out of high school at that time.
Well, I remember getting a flyer, and for some reason I thought it was there. It could have been at, like, Pandemonium Arcade. It could have been somewhere else. But Brick House, maybe. And they were like, yeah, this is a band called Emmanuel Nice, and, you know, they have a record. And... I mean, even being then, I remember just being taken aback. I'm like, here's a band of kids that are in high school. Like, I'm in high school, and they have a record deal. Back when you guys were on Raw Dog.
Raw Dog Records. No, it's weird because now, like, everybody has a band. But back then, there was nobody our age that had bands. The only, like, in our high school, your former band, Nick,
right,
the singer of your former band, was the only other dude, I think, that I knew near our age that had a, you know, sort of assembled a band. But at that time, he was kind of, I think he was playing John Mayer songs.
Right, yeah. Suburban Blood Drive was jazz. Like a jazz fusion.
Yeah, jazz fusion band.
Yeah. Now he's a sawduster, dude. He's gone back.
He doesn't, he's hardcore music does not, it's not in his repertoire anymore.
Not anymore. But I would love for it to be. Nick, come on out to
Let's
the show.
Let's get that
one
reunion
day.
Show. I'm calling it right now the Suburban Blood Drive reunion show.
Yeah, or at least just come on here and let's talk about the Sawdusters. You know what I'm saying? But so I remember thinking, these guys have a band and they have a record out. And I saw them with Piebald at the Brick House.
Oh,
and
yeah.
It kind of sealed the deal. It's like, these guys are the real deal. These guys are what I could be or what a lot of us could be that we're in high school and we're doing it. And you guys are only like, what, a year older than me? Two mm-hmm. years older than me?
Yeah, something like that.
I just turned 31.
Yeah, I'm not going to date myself, but I'm roughly 2 years older than you.
Roughly. Not quite, but roughly. And then, so how did high school trivia, like, how did that come about?
Well,
was that a Raw Dog release, or did Raw Dog pick that up?
No, it was actually picked up, man. No, so we were playing a lot of shows locally, and at that time, there was a label called White House Records that just did, there were bands from Louisville, from Bloomington, from Cincinnati, maybe a little further away, but just kind of a regional small punk record label. And we had been recording demos at that time. Barber had this brilliant recording method of overdubbing cassette tapes onto, like, not even using one of those machines where you're supposed to. I don't know how he did it, but maybe got us two or three tracks or channels out of the cassette tape. But anyways, we were recording demos and we played a lot of shows, and we had a little bit of a following with, like, people our age. Like, there weren't, I don't think there were a lot of 14-year-olds coming to punk rock shows until we started playing, and then they kind of came, we brought them along with us.
Right.
I may be wrong, but that's the way it seemed. And I don't know if Adam White, the guy that owned White House Records, thought that we were good, or thought that because we brought people to our shows that maybe he'd break even.
Right. Yeah.
That was the goal probably at that point. So I think he wanted us to go in and record like an EP. I guess it technically was an EP anyways, but a few songs. And I think when it was finished, and it wasn't good, but I guess by the standards those days, it was good enough. And so he just released all the songs. It was just like an 8-song deal, a bunch of 3.5-minute pop punk songs.
And were these recorded tape to tape, or did you actually get to go into a studio and kind of
do it? No, we went to a studio, it's not here anymore, I don't think. I don't remember where it was, but it was a nice, they seemed to have pretty good gear at the time. It was my first time in a real recording studio, I think.
Right.
ADETS, I think, was the format.
Yeah, man. You just record it to VHS, basically.
Yep. Slap that on a VHS tape and you're good to go. I was amazed. I was like, wait, those are tapes. Those are VHS tapes. But yeah, I think that's how we recorded it, and it sounded like shit, and the songs were pretty shitty. And
I don't know, dude. Shauna, it's a stone cold classic.
I ran into Shauna, the real life Shauna, not too long ago. I hadn't seen her in like a decade.
Didn't even know that was based on a real person.
Real person, yep. Real person. She was a senior. We were freshmen. She was real cool. Yeah.
Well, shout out to Shauna. Hope you're still just as cool.
I think she lives around here somewhere.
Well, hey, Shauna, if you're ever in the neighborhood, come on over. Let's talk about the song that you
get
got.
Her on. Have her on with Richard Neumeier and Nick Dittmeier.
Yeah.
It'd be a great show.
We will. We'll just do a reunion here, bro. But yeah, okay, so high school trivia comes about. It's the first time I ever heard you guys. I remember Aravat had a copy of the album, and she played it for me, and I was like, oh, snap, what is this? And then she's like, well, if you like this, let's go to Ear Ecstasy, check out this split they did with Colorbone.
Ah, yes.
Now that's a Raw Dog release there.
That's an original Raw Dog release. Yeah, Raw Dog bought out the remaining copies of the original pressing of 500 of High School Trivia. I'm sad to say, is unavailable today because all 500 copies have been sold.
Yes.
Nice. So hopefully a few people broke even on that.
I'm going to get on interpunk.com, see if I can still
you
find
might
one.
Be able
Interpunk
snatch, still, is it
still a website? And I remember going there like in high school and be like, I got to get my studded belt. I got to get my Aquabats t-shirt. Like, I got to order it off Interpunk. This is where all the punk kids go online. And they have a lot of back stock, needless to say.
Maybe there's a few sitting around there.
Yeah, and then so you do a split with a band called Colorbone.
Yes,
so and it's on Raw Dog. How do you go from White House to Raw Dog, which was what, based out of Germany or based out of another country of some sort?
Yeah, sorta. That's an interesting story. So it was not actually called Raw Dog, although it should have been. It was Rod Dog.
Rod Dog.
So
sorry.
In the,
you know, I've been saying Rod Dog this whole time, but I would just like to the raw. I just like to put a little accent on it.
It should have been called Raw Dog. So the Rod.
Now it makes sense. The guy's name was Rod. I should have seen that coming a mile away.
Yeah. So Rod, he had a Kentucky connection. I can't remember if he grew up in Kentucky. I met him through some people here when he was visiting here, but he lived in Germany and was one of those guys that wanted to help out, you know, and he actually, when we were doing summer tours when we were still in high school, he like at least once or twice, you know, kind of helped us out, at least with money, came out, drove, because we were 16 or 17. You know, I think our parents felt a little bit better having an adult there with us to kind of hang around and keep us in line, or at least keep us from getting murdered. But yeah, that's how it came to be. I think Rod paid for our first t-shirts ever, paid to have those printed, and that was real cool. And then
were they like the red ones?
They were mini colors. I think they were the scraps from the shop, and they just screen printed onto all these goofy ass colors. It was a heart and crossbones logo, which I believe has been used thousands of times by many similar similarly crappy bands.
It's probably like the Adobe Photoshop heart, that one that comes standard.
No, shape. I believe this was hand drawn.
Oh, gotcha.
I think Breen might have actually drawn it. I'm not sure.
Fair enough. You just proved me wrong at every turn.
That's what I'm here to do.
That's what I'm here to refute the statements.
Yeah. I'm setting the story straight.
Yeah.
The important facts.
Yeah, exactly.
Who designed that first tee, and was it Photoshopped?
No.
Was it was it clip art or was it not? No, that's hand drawn, Sean.
Gotcha.
Oh shit, I touched the spring.
No, you're guys, if you heard that, that's Brian Whiteman plucking a little bass here in the studio.
What is that, a B?
I think so.
That's low, dog.
Yeah, dude. That's not how the rest of the podcast goes.
Yeah,
it's
not
just gonna be a jam sesh here.
It's probably 7 or 8 years further down the road from where we're at right now in the story before we get to low B.
Right.
We haven't discovered down tuning yet.
Exactly. We haven't C sharp
Misery hasn't quite set in yet. We're still having fun at this point.
And I can't believe too, like, I remember being a kid watching, like, you guys had a music video too, and I remember watching that for Home Sweet Away, and it was like tour footage. And I was like, dude, these guys go out on summer tours.
I don't even know what the fuck you're talking about.
It's for Home Sweet Away.
Do you have this? I've never seen it.
I downloaded it off of, like, you know, it was like in QuickTime, and it was like in the crappiest transfer ever.
We didn't make that.
Well, it was like, it was on your website.
Hmm.
It was on the old Emmanuel Nice website, which you guys were like the first band that actually had a website that wasn't like a major band that I knew of. And then I saw the video, and it was like tour footage mixed with like footage of, you know, probably you guys at playing at Mom's Music or something like that.
Weird.
Like a Mom's Music show or like a Jeff High Talent show. But I was just like, man, these guys actually tour. They have a van, and like, here's them at the beach, and here's them at, you know.
I would love to see this.
Well, hopefully we can find it. Listeners, if you have this video, let's, you know, email it to me. Let's hook Brian up with some of it. You'd be surprised how much you can find here. There's a group called 812 and 502 Bands on Facebook, and shout out to you guys. But someone has a Dropbox or has compiled a Dropbox with MP3s of every local band ever, basically. Every Louisville band, all of their demos and everything, the unreleased stuff, the stuff you'll never be able to get again, it is saved for posterity on Dropbox.
Wow.
I used it for my Uh-Huh Baby Yeah retrospective, so bands like Tears Like Bullets and Monroe and Heartbreak Kid and all that other stuff, I found the music there. So you might, hey guys, if you got the video, hook it up. So, but yeah, you guys were like, you had a video. And then that brings me to the Wait EP.
Right.
Now that was, I feel, maybe a turning point for you guys. It was definitely a turning point for me listening to you guys, because I was like, this is 100% like a professional band at this point. You guys are probably 18, 19, 20.
Yeah, I think
20.
18 at that point probably. We were definitely in high school when we recorded it. I know that. So it was probably junior, senior year, 17 or 18, I'd say, when we did that. Yeah, that was, we had, I think, the boys were using a lot more grass, getting a little more creative, listening a lot more classic rock. We got off of all that bad, bad early or late 90s, like pop punk stuff.
Yeah. The Blink 182 influence.
Yes. Kind of getting out of that stuff.
And, the Alex Mack influence. The GC. You guys got off the GC 161 and got on the THC 161.
Yeah. So I don't know. The songs were better for sure. We were better players. Songs were better. They're more interesting songs. I really, probably, like arrangement wise, we were more interesting at that point than maybe at any other point, because we really haven't figured out songwriting necessarily, but parts were there and it made more sense. Plus, we were like jacking way cooler band stuff at that time. I think Get Up Kids and Saves the Day had happened, and like we were more into that sort of stuff at that point. But I think that had a little bit more of a classic rock punk vibe, maybe. Yeah. I don't know. But also there's the song, the piano ballad, played by my lovely ex-girlfriend from 1999 or whatever.
Is that the one about being your Doc Holiday? Something about being in a photograph?
Yeah.
You guys were being in a photograph way before Nickelback was. You guys
Before Filter, right? That wasn't the same thing.
Oh, yeah.
That was probably about the same time, actually. I don't know what that song was called.
Something in a photograph, I think.
Yeah, something like that. It was emo as fuck.
Yeah.
Emo.
Hey, that's fine, though. I thought it was cool, though. I thought that, like, I remember listening to, like, for a long time, Kerosene and Oils, like, was, like, on every mixtape that I ever had. I was like, dude, this song is the jam, dude.
That was a long one, too.
Yeah.
That thing was, like, 5.5 minutes long. I think it was the longest song we ever released.
That was a good one, though. And I remember downloading Home Sweet Away and a song called Indian Giver. Engine Giver.
Is what it was called. We would have never used language like that.
Engine Giver is what it was called. That's just off of the website, right, man. Back in the day, same place as the
Was that
video.
A ripper? I feel like I remember that song, and it was like a fairly intense song.
But it came out around the same era of the Wait EP. But
was it a B-side?
I don't think it even made it. Yeah, it had to have been a B-side.
You know what's weird? When we did the Wait EP, I think we were sitting on better songs. But it took a while to get in, and I think we had this ambitious plan. We're going to do this 4-song EP and then come back with all this great shit that we've got sitting in the, in the well. And none of it was ever legitimately recorded. I think I have some CDs around the house of those recordings, because by that time, you know, we were able to do decent, you know, home recordings that, you know, just weren't god awful. And Matt was always pretty good at getting those to sound pretty good. I'd like to go back and listen to some of those now, but we were sitting on better songs. Learned something early on in this game, the old game. Don't sit on good songs. Release the motherfuckers and write some more. So I don't know. We probably screwed up there. That was the first of many bad business decisions.
Well, same advice applies today, guys. If you have your best song, don't wait to put it out on an album now. Since the game has changed, just
drop it. Just drop it.
Go ahead and shoot a video for it and put it on YouTube right now. Yeah. Okay, even if the video's not all that great, do it now. You don't need a full album anymore. You don't even need an EP anymore. You don't even need a CD. Just put it on YouTube. You got it.
No.
I should take my own advice and maybe put this on YouTube. It's the audio's on there, guys. The videos, I need to run it through Neumeier's workstation before.
Let's get back with Neumeier on that.
Yeah.
If he's still
Maybe he'll
with
let
us
use the Avid.
Oh, yeah.
I remember it was a special treat if you wanted to use the Avid. Otherwise, you had to edit on 2 VHS tapes.
We should get a hold of the old mixer. I don't even know what you call it, but the thing that did the visual effects.
Yeah,
oh,
exactly.
God. That must be what Tim and Eric use on their show.
It's got to be with the... The character generator.
Oh my God, dude, that thing was weird.
I would love to have a character generator. All my stuff would just be like that. I'm a guy that doesn't care. I love the way old stuff looks, VHS tape and everything looks. So I'd be all about it. I'm going to have the only podcast filmed on a VHS.
You should, when you do get around to doing video with this, you should do it on the WJHS set. You should just get the set and sit there and fucking do it. The old Louisville skyline, pre whatever the dome building's called.
Right, yeah. The bank or whatever.
Yeah.
Yes. And then, okay, everything changed for your band. At least I would say everything changed for your band from my aspect when 2004 rolled around. Okay, 2004 rolled around, and there was a lot of rumors and happenings in the Emmanuel camp because they're like, you know, hey, Emmanuel just signed with this thing called Feta Booking, and Emmanuel just got signed to Vagrant Records, and Emmanuel has an album that's going to be coming out. Now, granted, the album didn't come out in 2004.
No, it took much longer.
Yes, it certainly did. How did you go from being, you know, playing in your parents' garage or your parents' house or TB's basement or what have you to winding up with Feta Booking, winding up with Vagrant Records?
The Feta thing happened way before Vagrant, probably a good year before Vagrant. We had recorded a 3-song demo, basically. We were holed up in Matt's grandma's basement, which is where we spent the later years before we kind of got our own place where we had those little demo studios that we had over those few years.
Right.
And we had like a permanent recording setup. We're making decent sounding demos. And I think, I don't remember, it might have been one of those last Crazy Fests. And Midtown was playing.
Mm-hmm.
And I had promoted some shows for Midtown kind of early on when they were, I guess, kind of blowing up for the first time. That had to have been in like 99 or 2000, maybe 2001. But we were friends with those guys, and Gabe Saporta, kind of the, I guess, businessman of that outfit, was over hanging out in the basement with us, I guess, day before the show or something. And so Gabe's in there, and he's like, I think, you know, you guys, this is good stuff. I think I can do something with it. And, he's like, record 3 more songs, but I'll take this. So he takes it and starts running around, you know, playing it for people. And within like a few months, we're starting to get phone calls from people. So we never even shopped it. Like, it just kind of got out there via him. He was kind of working with that band Armor for Sleep at the time.
Mm-hmm.
Give it, you know, those guys got a hold of it. So they're on the road constantly. Midtown's on the road. And they're just kind of playing it for people that they meet. Like people that work for their bands or whatever, and all of a sudden there's all this you know, interest starting to generate. And I think not long after that, we had 3 more songs demoed, and we had like a 6-song demo tape. And it's getting handed around, we're getting calls, you know, certain, I don't remember the order of things exactly, but like indie labels are starting to come to us, and, you know, management companies. I think Feta got on board on the first 3-song version. And that was at the time the coolest thing that ever happened to us, because that was like the cool booking agency at the time. They had like Hot Water Music and Pretty Girls Make Graves and just a lot of cool bands.
Yeah. Well, that's still one of probably the coolest things that's ever happened to a Louisville band, period. Besides maybe My Morning Jacket yeah. or what have you.
So that was really exciting, because then we, you know, all of a sudden we got the opportunity to go on real tours for the first time that we don't have to book. Which is freaking amazing, because booking tours sucks. It sucked then. It probably still sucks. But we're doing that stuff. That's happening. We're getting better shows. People are interested. And then at some point, hold on, I got to go back, because it's funny. Avange Lovanos, who was our manager, was our booking agent at Feta. So there was Eva, the owner, and Avange, and they ran Feta. And Avange was doing a podcast like a month or two ago, and she sent me a link. She's like, hey, I talked about you guys in this podcast, so I listened to it. She called us a bunch of Indiana Hicks, or Kentucky Hicks. Hicks from Kentucky, I think is what she called us. Anyways, she's telling the story that I didn't remember about how we used to write her love letters, like pen and paper love letters, and mail them to her about our band. and we, you know, we'd of course put a demo, you know, a CD in there.
Yes.
And she said, you know, I never listened to it. And it wasn't until Gabe came to her, you know, months and months later, and was like, handed her the same demo, and you got to listen to this. And she's like, holy shit, it's those fucking weirdos that have been writing me love letters. So she picked us up because she liked it. And she later became our manager.
That's a lost art, though. I'm so glad that you happened to mention that, because there was a time when we were sending press kits, and that's just a lost art, sending a press kit physical. Mm-hmm. It's almost unheard of anymore, but we were sending them out all the time, and we would have like our rejection letters from Victory Records.
Sure.
And we would have our rejection letters from such
and
such.
At least they took the time to write you a letter.
This is pre-MySpace.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying, mm-hmm. too? MySpace kind of changed the game, I feel.
Yeah, you got signed based on MySpace plays
exactly.
after a while, yeah.
But you would send all that stuff out, and I remember like, well, we got to get fancier envelopes. We got to stand out.
Yeah,
you know what I'm
that's
saying?
That's all like, bullshit. It yeah, never worked anyways.
Never worked. We got like a graphic designer friend of mine to like design a one sheet that looked so like what we thought was like super cool. I'm sure it's ridiculous now, unreadable. But you know, that's a lost art of actually having to physically send your stuff in the mail to someone for consideration. And most of the time, I'm sure it just lays around.
Yeah, I would say 99% of the time it does not get listened to.
And that's crazy too. So you met Gabe what back in, you said 99, 2000?
Yeah, probably.
So early?
Yeah, I mean, I booked Midtown at Tech World in
probably
99, 2000. Yeah. And yeah, it was crazy. It was like one of the bigger shows we had played at that time. I think we had like 250 people out for that. And, you know, I'm not sure if people knew Midtown in Louisville at the time or not. But yeah, it was good. And then I think we did another show together in Louisville, and then Midtown ended up taking us out on one of our first kind of real tours, a short run, but sometime around that same time where the demos were happening, and it was Armor for Sleep and Midtown and us, and maybe I think the band Silverstein from Canada was on that, and that was super fun. It was only like four or five shows, but it was, you know, we had never seen lines or sold out shows before,
right?
And you know, I remember that, I think the first show we played with those guys was in Orlando, and I guess we'd been in sound check, and we come out and we walk out, and we're like, oh, holy fuck, there's 500 people just standing waiting to get in. This is insane. So that was really cool.
It's a game changer.
Yeah, we've made it.
Yeah, exactly. And really you have, because now if you can sell, you know, 500 tickets, that ain't too shabby.
No, you can make a living selling 500 tickets.
Yeah, exactly. So that leads us up to Feta. So you got in touch with Yvonge.
Mm-hmm.
Based on your relationship with Gabe.
Yep.
And so you guys weren't even actively shopping. It just kind of happened.
No, they did it for
chance.
Us. Yeah, and that's the best way to do it. So, like, that whole thing, Gabe, Midtown, I guess at that time, was managed by a management company called Crush Management, who did, like, Fall Out Boy, probably still does Fall Out. I mean, a lot of huge bands at that time, although this was pre-Fall Out Boy. But that was a big company, and Bob, the owner of that company, wanted to work with us, and for whatever reason, we decided not to. But he managed a producer called Machine, who produced soundtrack to a Head Rush. So,
which is still the, I don't know if you know this, this is still that soundtrack to a Head Rush is still the bar in which bands like try to make their album. Like, they're like, we want it to sound as good as Soundtrack to a Head Rush. At least that's my band.
We'll call Machine.
Yeah, I know, right? Unfortunately, it was a little bit out of our budget.
Yeah.
So we got to call Jordan Haynes. He does a good job.
Okay. Well, these days, you can just sound replace all that shit. It doesn't matter. Anybody, any old dickhead can make a record that sounds like that.
Dick, and Harry can be a machine.
Yeah. Yeah, you just need $8,000 worth of stuff from Guitar Center and you're
all
good to go.
All you need is a machine.
Yeah.
You know, a
yeah.
computer and all that sort of thing.
Yeah.
Some plugins.
Yeah, so we weren't.
It's not easy, Jordan. You rock, by the way.
I don't know that dude. What's up, Jordan? So Bob presents the idea to us. Hey, why don't you do a record with this dude, Machine? He really likes your stuff, and it's on spec. We don't have a record deal at this point, you know. And we're like, oh, cool. Yeah, let's just go make a fucking record and see what happens with that. So the songs are there. We've got 10 songs. We drive out to New Jersey, crash on the way, our first van crash. We hit black ice in Ohio.
When you say crash on the way, I'm like, oh, well, you probably just stayed over at somebody's house. You mean you actually got into an accident?
Yeah, we crashed.
Yeah, an actual crash, guys. It's cool. We can laugh about it now. Everybody was safe.
Everybody, no one was hurt in that one. No, we hit a bunch of black ice, slid for like, it was the funniest crash ever because we're sliding like hundreds and hundreds of feet and it's the middle of the night, no other cars around, so we're not gonna like hurt anybody or anything like that. And it's like, oh, everybody wake up, I think we're gonna crash. And we're like, oh, okay, good, everybody got their seat belts on, yeah, give me a second. before you crash, let me... Okay, good. And then still sliding, and then we hit an overpass. But at just nice enough angle that it wasn't real intense. I don't know if that van had airbags. I assume it did not. They did not deploy.
I don't know if that was a safety recall or anything years later.
96 conversion van. I don't know if they had them or not. It presses the bumper like up into the wheel. So we probably could have just drove on, but we can't because we're jammed up. We're jammed up over there on the side of the road.
Jammed up super hard.
Fuck Ohio, by the way. Always jamming us up. But we're sitting there. We're like, fuck. Like, it's so icy. It's just like a football field of black ice out there. Like, we are going to get killed by a semi. A semi is going to crash into us and kill us. So we're all just chain smoking. Like, guys, it was nice knowing you. We had a good run here. We made it. We made it. But we got out. A tow truck comes and is able to actually pry the bumper back. And we're like, I think we could drive. So we continue on. We make it as far as Allentown, Pennsylvania, when what I assume was a side effect of the crash causes like a bearing or something to blow out in the front wheel. So we're done there. Allentown, this is like the next morning. We're supposed to start recording that day. Allentown's only like 2 hours from New York. So Machine and one of his boys jump in a car and pickup truck in a car, and they come get us. So we leave the van. We load all our shit in there. Head down. Like, same day, we're unloading, setting up. Pre-production starts the next day. Like, we had 3 weeks to make that record, which, you know, when you're making a record like that, that's not a lot of time. By comparison, we spent 2 months on Black Earth Tiger.
Right.
But that urgency, I think, also made it the way it was, which was a good thing. I think.
Well, that crash, too, probably adds just to the certain... I mean, there's like a piss and vinegar to soundtrack to a head rush.
Yeah. We didn't even have a good reason to be pissed off yet. We probably should have flip-flopped those records. It was a cool recording experience. Like, we were 20. I don't know if I was 20. I was the youngest till D. Tommy came along. I was 19 or 20. And so we're working, you know, 12, 16, 18 hours a day, 6 days a week, and just jamming it in that time period. And we were about half the time we lived in Machine's studio, which was the control room. We did pre-production, tracked drums in a real big place. But everything else was done in his little place, which was basically like a booth and a control room. And he had like a loft, and that's where we slept at night. So we literally never left. And we're like, Machine, dog, we need some beers, man. And he's like, all right, I got you guys. And he runs over and he comes back with 6 beers. And we're like, Machine, motherfucker, do you have any idea?
I got dibs on 2 beers.
Yeah. Who's getting the 2 beers tonight? Yeah. Good Lord. So,
well, Matt got 2 beers yesterday, and then Matt got 2 beers the day before that.
We just paper, rock, scissors tournament for the extra beer. But, you know, he knew better than to let us get drunk, because we probably wouldn't have been very productive. Now, thinking back, the idea of making that record as sober as we probably actually were is ridiculous. But we did. Yeah, it was pretty sober.
It was a pretty sobering experience.
Yeah. But
we dried out. It was like rehab.
I think the second week and a half or 2 weeks, we stayed with a buddy of ours, Lucas, who lived in Brooklyn. And so we'd wrap it up there and head over to Brooklyn. And you know, in this Polish neighborhood, they'd sell beer to any guy, any old boy.
Any old boy right off the street. Any Kentucky hick.
There's no, yeah.
Off the street.
Yeah, no shit, man. I couldn't have looked older than 16. No questions asked. It was fucking fantastic.
You're baby-faced now. Yeah. You look young.
Yeah, maybe
now,
since I realize,
can imagine how young you looked then.
I realize now that there are no cameras in here, so maybe we should describe to your audience how I look.
Yeah, describe. Well, I'm very, very neatly coiffed.
Yeah, I got a haircut today, Sean, if you couldn't tell, because I thought there'd be cameras here. I didn't know what a podcast was, man.
Yeah, so needless to say, I have a perfect 5 o'clock shadow.
Oh yeah, I trimmed that up today too.
You know, thank you, man. I appreciate that. So not only did you prepare a great look, but you've also prepared a piece from Soundtrack to a Head Rush. Yeah, you have. Don't worry. We already talked about it in pre-production.
Oh, okay. It's happening. Okay.
Yeah. So we're gonna play a song. We're gonna play a song called "The Hey Man," which. The Hey Man, I remember the demo of it streaming on the Emmanuel Nice website way back in the day.
Yeah, that song, I think we wrote that before we dropped the Nice.
Yeah.
That was the first song written made it on the soundtrack to Head Rush.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
Well, not only is it the first song written, but it's probably the largest banger on the album, which is filled with bangers.
It's an album of bangers.
This one's pretty raw dog. if you ask me.
God.
But yeah, and yeah, we're gonna play it here on the show. So we're gonna take a little musical break here. This is the Hey Man by Emmanuel. All right, guys, that was the Hey Man by Emmanuel, one of my favorite jams that rocks hard. You know that. I'm here in the studio. Whiteman is still here. The bad boy of fishing. He's still here. Yeah. He didn't run off in the middle of the song break.
Why didn't you say taking me to Toontown like you said you were going?
Yeah, I know. That was the Hey Man. That was Emmanuel taking you to Toontown, ladies and gentlemen.
The Guy Fieri of podcast.
Hey, man, I've already got the build. I just wish I had hair.
Oh, man, you can get that hair. They make wigs.
That's true, man. I can be wearing
specific wigs that look exactly like his head. You get the visor on it. It's got the rest of his head on top.
You know, I've always said this, and then randomly someone else had the same, drew the same conclusions and made a meme out of it. I wish that was me. But years ago, I remember posting, like, you ever wonder if Guy Fieri is just Violent J from ICP without makeup on? Like, you never see him in the same place at the same time. And someone made a meme because they do look almost exactly alike, minus, you know, some clown makeup.
I think it's probably the same guy.
That's what I'm saying.
Flavortown.
But let's get back to Flavortown. Oh, that's money right there. Let's get back to business here. So where we left off before the song break, you guys had just recorded with Machine for soundtrack to a Head
Gene
Rush.
Gene the Machine Freeman.
Gene the Machine Freeman. Man, I don't know
if anybody knows his real name. I don't know if I'm going to get in trouble for that. I wonder if I signed anything back then.
A non-disclosure agreement. Like, yeah. You will never say that my first name is Gene. Mean Gene Machine.
Good old Gene.
So, yeah, and you guys brought it back home. I remember when you guys brought it back home, and this actually makes sense because randomly, you guys needed your gear needed a ride to Indianapolis one day to go play with Sparta. And
yes.
There was no van. And me, Wes Carroll, and Kevin Fletcher rode up to Indy and caught the show.
Did you all drive our gear?
Wes had a truck. I had a truck too at that time.
Yeah.
Wes,
I remember the show. I don't remember how our gear got there.
Yeah. Wes Carroll.
Interesting.
Yeah. So that makes sense. And I remember the moment when I think it was you or Breen or somebody was like, you got to hear what we have just done. And hearing it was a game changer. That's when I was like, this is the craziest sounding album I've ever heard, maybe ever.
Well, no bands at that time. I don't know if any... There were no like legitimate producers making, you know, albums like that for no-name bands.
That's true.
That wasn't happening at the time. So to hear some, I guess it would be quite shocking.
That's so great. The look you just gave me. I guess it would be quite shocking to the layman here. Yeah. And then, you know, oddly enough, right after that, it just seemed like a lot of people were recording with Machine because, you know, Armor for Sleep's we
put that son of a bitch on the map.
Gene the Machine, you heard it first here, bro.
Yeah, he did Armor. He did Fall Out Boy. He did
Every Time I Die.
He did... I don't remember if he did anything else, but I mean, he was doing Clutch and like King Crimson, and he had worked with some really cool British bands that never got going.
Well, nobody in my high school would have been like, "Hey, man, did you check out the new King Crimson?"
Yeah, nobody. No. I don't know if anybody.
Maybe somebody from high school's father would have been like, "Hey, did this new King Crimson rocks?"
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah.
But still, you know. So here we are. That's probably 2000. We're still in 2004 here because I definitely remember. When you guys came home, played that huge show that my band played. It was like our first big break, really, at the Executive Inn. Because before that, we were just selling out PJ's Cafe.
Yes.
You know, a bakery / random music venue.
That was a classic show. That was amazing. So, me and I feel like everybody in the goddamn band worked at this place at some point anyways, in the mall food court, which is now Bass Pro Shops.
You're working what, Steak Escape or something?
Steak Escape, baby. And the owner of Steak Escape, super cool dude, had a hookup at the hotel. And I guess somehow we talked him into like, all right, rent us that ballroom. We're going to have a show. And we brought in, I guess, our PA gear and you know, had some bands. And I guess they brought in a bar, but shit, I can't imagine more than 10 of those 300 people were over 21.
Yeah.
But everybody was drunk somehow. Yeah, there's a lot of parking lot drinking going down. But that show was fucking amazing.
That's epic, man. That's one of my favorite shows that I've ever played in my decade-long career of playing music.
Yeah, it was crazy. I mean, there were like 40 people on stage, and then like the whatever 260 left in the crowd. Like a lot of stage diving. Because we'd always been, you know, growing up in this town, we were playing rental halls or coffee shops or whatever.
Bowling alleys, yeah. Ryan Davis's basement.
Yes. And none of those places had stages or anything. So that shit was wild. Yeah, I don't remember much else except that it was a lot of fun.
It was packed.
I remember people on stage dancing, kept unplugging our amps, you know, because they're like behind the amps and stuff like that. But besides that, it was good. It was really fun. That was a good one.
That's my first band, Tears Like Bullets, opening up the show there, guys.
Nice.
And then Suburban Blood Drive played before I
was
in the band.
That was Tears Like Bullets taking you to Flavortown.
Oh, taking you to the Toontown.
Wait, sorry, Toontown.
And then, yeah, Suburban Blood Drive played before I was in that band. Uh-huh. And who else? I want to say like maybe Christensen or somebody opened.
Did they?
Right after. Right.
Yeah, I think maybe Christensen did. I don't know.
Could have been that.
The Big Dogs.
Amherst or Sleepwell Apparatus or somebody else could have been there.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't
they
remember.
Would have been around at the time. But, yeah.
Probably
one of those things. One of those things where we're just like, yeah, but probably. We just all reminisced. We just reminisced in our heads.
I don't fucking
there.
Know. I can't remember those things.
So anyway, soundtrack to Head Rush has been recorded.
It's created at
it's
this point.
It's in the can,
yeah,
if you will. Mm-hmm. And how do you, from there, did Vagrant find the album or did Vagrant, had you already signed to Vagrant at that point?
No, we were unsigned for quite a while after that, I think. So I guess the record's finished, if you say so. I don't remember if it was done at that point or not, but it must have been.
I certainly had a burnt copy of it.
Okay,
by that point.
All right. Then it was done. So no, we're just kind of letting it do its thing. I don't know if at this point we're actually sending stuff to labels. I don't know if we ever did. I think it all did it. You know, it was an organic thing. It was making its rounds, and people were hearing it, and we were getting flown to, you know, coast to coast to meet with people, and you know, eating sushi for the first time. We got to eat Kentucky Hicks, you know,
yeah, bunch of Kentucky Hicks, man.
I remember having shark in Manhattan, and then we were like late, like we had to be on stage. We're just wrapping up dinner with a guy. It was Nitro Records. Took us to sushi. Homeboy has no thumbs, which we bonded on because I had an extra one at one point. But he keeps dogging us because none of us can use chopsticks. And he's like, guys, I don't have any fucking thumbs. Look, like it's not that hard. But anyways, we eat all this food that freaked us out. And then we have to sprint back to the Knitting Factory to play a show on a bunch of raw fishes and things. But yeah, we're doing a bunch of that back and forth. You know, the interest is picking up. We're kind of feeling things out and, yeah, saying nay to a lot of offers and trying to figure out where we want to be. Because it was a good situation. And I mean, I can't imagine there's a whole lot of bands that get lucky enough to get into a position like that where you've got a finished product that people want. I mean, the label knows exactly what they're getting. They can't change your goddamn album. It's already right. done. Although I think Vagrant ended up having it remixed in a more lame sounding way. But
you heard it here.
They had to have a say in it somehow, you know.
We had to have some sort of radio frequencies in between some of the songs.
No, that was already there.
Oh, gotcha. Sorry. Yeah.
No, they had no creative input. They were just like, we need more kick drum because we know what we're talking about. We know more than Gene the Machine Freeman. So, yeah, let's tell him to change it because we know fucking more about mixing records. I don't know. But, yeah, so Vagrant's like the last one to the table. Like, we're real close to signing to another label at this point.
What other labels were interested at that point?
I think at this point we had decided we weren't going to do majors. So, major labels, I think, were out of the picture at this point. And we were talking with Ferret, Fiddler, and Fueled by Ramen. I think were the kind of ones we had narrowed it down to. And then Vagrant was the last one to the table. And, you know, we were big fans of all their bands growing up, and it was really cool. They flew out to see us, acted like they liked it, flew us out to LA to meet with everybody, do that whole thing. And, you know, shortly thereafter made an offer that was too good to refuse.
Couldn't refuse.
So we did it. That was it. We finally, after probably a fucking year since Soundtrack was actually finished, maybe not that long, maybe it was like 6 or 8 months, but at this point we have a record deal. So we're good to go. Put the motherfucker out. Not gonna happen.
How long did it actually take them from the time you signed to the time that the label came out? Because I mean, I remember your album release show was maybe like 2 years after I had listened to the album.
I think
album.
It had to have been close, man. It was definitely longer than a year. It came out in what, May of 2005? Does that sound right?
It sounds yeah, probably.
It was the Ides of March. No, maybe it was March. March, because it was
the
Ides
of March.
Yeah, and we realized
the Ides of May.
We realized
the second most
that
popular
we
Ides.
Really fucked up and didn't market it as the Ides of March. But yeah, so it sat around a long time, and you know, hundreds of people in the music business had copies of this thing, and you know, press people I'm sure got a hold of it and all this. So like, there were message boards back then. Like, what was the one?
Initial Records message board.
That never got any
Emmanuel
love.
Emmanuel sucks and King Horse rocks.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's more like, Emmanuel, I kicked those guys' asses at Taco Bell next to the Brick House in 97. Those guys are pussies.
Those guys are pussies, man. Slint rocks.
Yeah. That's pretty much what it was. Like, all these sensitive dudes kicking our asses, apparently. But yeah, that was funny. We got zero love in Louisville, that's for sure. It's funny because I'm friends with a lot of those dudes that were epic shit talkers back then. Like, I don't know this guy. Why is he so mad at me?
Why did he beat me up at a Taco Bell?
Yeah, which never happened. Yeah, but why is he telling people to beat me up? Why does he want to beat me up so bad?
That must be a Louisville thing, because that was the exact same thing just years later that happened with our band. I feel like Louisville just didn't get what we were doing. Of course, by the time we came around, well, and even then too, when you guys were around, Louisville was just saturated with heavier music.
Yeah.
Their own kind of brand of like Initial Records sounding.
Sure, yeah. We never fit in with that crowd at all.
And we never did either. By the time that we were around, it was all metalcore and all
Hot Topic had happened.
Exactly.
My Chemical Romance had happened.
Exactly. But even people in Louisville weren't into like anything that remotely was like pop sounding or rock sounding at that point. So we just had to go elsewhere.
Yeah.
You know, it was like, well, if Louisville's not going to have us, North Carolina sure had us, mm-hmm. and Florida would have us, and all these other places would have us. But then, you know, it took a long time, but once our first album came along, it became the exact same thing where people actually started changing their tune. And once Warped Tour happened for us, mm-hmm. it was over.
Yeah, yeah. Then they paid a little more attention, I guess. I mean, we always had, you know, are like loyal fans, I guess, but they were a little younger than that. So that, you know, that initial crowd, initial wanted to sign us too, by the way. those guys were fine. It was just the underlings of
those
all those bands.
Loved.
It was the people that liked all the bands that were on initial that hated everything, which was 99% dudes, which is just like, and you know, we had a, you know, a 50-50 crowd probably. And, it was just a different crowd. You know, it was kids that wanted to have fun because that's what we were doing. And it wasn't like a scene thing. It wasn't like a cool thing. It was like, I want to go watch this loud-ass band play and mosh and have fun and get drunk.
A big thing, too, is I'm sure a lot of people had a lot of things to say, just as there were bands whenever I was around that had a lot of people had a lot of things to say. If you're the band that draws women to the show,
yeah,
you're targeted. But you got to draw the women to the show because the women enjoy the music and the guys want to go there because there's going to be women there.
I guess. I don't know if that was the case then or if it still is or not.
It's the case since the beginning of time, man.
Yeah, I guess so.
You know what I'm saying?
Know.
It's
yeah,
just the
it
way
probably
it is.
It probably is.
So, okay, you've turned down Initial Records.
Yeah.
You've turned down Universal and other major labels, which is probably a good idea, even though I feel like by the time your album came out, all these bands were on a major label at that point.
Yeah.
Like, because like the major labels had bought out like Newfound Glory and, mm-hmm. and stuff like that.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, those bands had a chance to grow and have an organic fan base before
That's
they
true.
Did that stuff. So, I mean, it was advised by most people in that world, like the independent world, like
don't
start out,
break.
Yeah.
On major.
Yeah. Start out. Cause you'll just get lost in the mix. Go with the label that cares about you. That's serious about your band. And I think Vagrant was. I just don't think that they were equipped to break us or any other band that had not previously released anything. And everybody warned us. They're like, what are you doing? You can't sign to Vagrant. They've never broken a band. I'm like, I don't fucking care, man. Our record's good. You heard our fucking record?
And plus, Vagrant at the time was as hot as you could get, man.
Yeah, they were.
Saves the Day,
yeah.
Dashboard, Get Up Kids, Alkaline Trio.
Yeah, all of them.
Grade, you know,
yeah.
A bunch of tight bands.
It was good. Anniversary.
The Anniversary, yep.
The Bled. It was good. Yeah, I mean, they had everything going at the time. So I don't, you know, look back and say, oh, man, maybe we shouldn't have done that. But
yeah, you absolutely should have. And if Vagrant called me tomorrow, but hey, man, I want to sign your podcast, I'd be like, okay.
They need to call about those B-sides and rarities. I got some sweet-ass demos. A lot of hip-hop action, some jam sessions.
A lot of 812 Dirty Squad
yeah.
that I can... 812 Dirty Squad, I didn't even think to put it down in our list of things to talk about. But now that you brought it up and it's organically on topic... That is an album that, and those are songs that I still, to this day, will play for people. And they'll be
which
like,
album are you talking about? The High Life Volume 1, Fat Pussy Magic,
Canadian
or,
Bacon?
I don't even remember all the rest of them. That was an efficient songwriting regime there.
Yeah, absolutely.
Pumping out hits.
Yeah. Well, in a lot of times, bands like, again, here's another time you're trendsetting, because before, like... Now bands like you know, Riff Raff or rappers like Riff Raff or Dirt Nasty or these people kind of sound like what 812 Dirty Squad was doing at the time, where it was just like a bunch of white boys.
Well, you know, the amazing thing about Riff Raff is that our boy DJA Doc Money fucking produce Riff Raff.
I know.
It's amazing, right? But no, I can guarantee you that Riff Raff had no fucking idea, like, anything about what we were doing. That dude's like an old school Houston rapper.
Yeah, he won't
total
know,
but weirdo. Still. But yeah, I mean, if you want to talk about white rappers, maybe that was
yeah. But the thing is people like that. So a lot of times I'm like, well, you got to check out 812 Dirty Squad, yep, because this is from my hometown, mm-hmm, and it's dudes from bands rapping and doing it quite well and in a very awesome way. You know?
Yeah, that was some funny stuff.
Referencing Sparks and MySpace.
Oh,
which,
God. Timely.
Yeah, exactly. Those things aren't going to last forever. It doesn't.
No.
It didn't.
Mm-mm. Oof.
Oof.
Dirty Squad.
But yeah. Oh, a great Derek Allen story, by the way, is we're in L.A. recording our third album. And we're there for like a few weeks. And one day, Doc Money invites us to a cookout at his house, and John Burke is living there too.
You mean Dirty J?
I mean Dirty J.
Let's only refer to him. And
I mean Begelbson. Begelbson's there, and Dirty J is there, and so we hang out, and we're drinking beers, and we're listening to music, and lo and behold, Chris Owens,
oh boy,
comes over.
The old son of a bitch himself.
That old son of a gun. And Owens is like, hey man, you guys want to drink some mezcal, dude? And so of course we're like, yeah. And then he goes and he's like, we got to go to my house to get it. And I guess Kevin goes to get it in a truck that has plates that have had to have been expired for at least 4 or 5 years.
Sure.
To his house and to go get mezcal. And he's showing him a bunch of high grade, I don't know, military guns.
Oh my god.
He's like, yeah man, I mean, he's got a sweet gun collection. And then we came back and drank some mezcal with out of a cactus or something like that. I can't remember what it was, but it was awesome, dude. Chris Owens is the jam. If you've never partied with Chris Owens, listeners, you need to, trust me on this. Chris Owens, oddly enough, was the guy that did all of our early demos. So
yeah, he did one of ours too.
Really?
Yep.
It's so funny.
Way back in the day, like 98, 99 or something like that.
It's so great because he just does like the most heavy, brutal, like Louisville style metal, mm-hmm, and then here he is just like, you guys, this is sounding like he almost I would say in a way invented the style of Uh-Huh Baby Yeah, which was you have a pop song but your production is so heavy and brutal that it just doesn't even sound pop anymore.
Yeah,
you know.
Well, now he just builds studios for like
beautiful studios.
Builds studios for I don't know, what do you call that music? The dubstep artists.
Yeah,
yeah,
the rich people.
Yeah,
the
yeah,
rich and
the
famous.
The fucking guys that figured out how to make money.
So
in this,
you know,
business.
What Chris Owens does every day? He just cashes a paycheck and laughs at our asses, yeah, here in Louisville.
Cleans his guns.
Shout out to you, Owens. I love you, buddy. I got to get you on this show. But
he ain't
yeah,
coming on. I can guarantee you.
yeah.
Fuck you, Owens.
Dude,
I hope you're listening.
You heard it first from Brian Wyman. So yeah, and then okay, so you guys decided to go with Vagrant.
Yep.
You signed your name on the dotted line.
Yes.
You decided to go to the Nike factory and get a sweet amount of merch. You're the only band that I ever knew of with a Nike sponsorship. How did that come about? Inquiring minds need to know.
Yeah. Well, I know a lot of them, but...
of course you do. You're in the inn. Nobody like me knows about about a Nike sponsorship.
No, so I guess Eva or Avange was friends with this guy, Tim Bergevin, who was the Nike, like the music guy back then. He still works for Nike. He's in Europe somewhere now. He's a good man. One of my favorite dudes of all time. But he was into our shit. Like, we go into their, like, showroom and somewhere near L.A., and we walk in, and this dude's just cool as fuck. And he's like, just tell me whatever you want. And he's got, like, an early iPad. It's, like, pre-iPad, but he's got some kind of fucking flat thing that he touches, and it tells somebody in the back to bring shit out to us. So we're going through, I'll take that. You know, we're just loading up with stuff. He's clicking buttons. Next thing you know, some dude comes out of the warehouse with a big old bag of stuff for you. It's amazing. And then they did, like, we worked
it's
on...
like service merchandise.
It was like service merchandise, but you didn't have to give them any money, and the shit was way cooler.
Yeah.
And they also, needless to say, outfitted the Dirty Squad as well.
by default.
Could you throw in some windbreakers and shit?
Do you have any satin jogging suits yeah, here or yeah, some crushed velvet?
Yes.
But yeah, so I'll tell you what, this is probably where we're going to stop for the first part, because I feel like we are right where we need to be. We're teetering up towards the apex.
Oh, the apex already happened, buddy. This okay. is we're on the downslope.
You think so?
I'll explain in part two.
Part two. All right, guys. Well, if you enjoyed part one, part two's coming up here before too long. I'm going to release it. I don't know. I might release it in the same day. I might release it the next day after, whatever. So whatever. It's a podcast, dude. You can listen to it anytime you want. By the time you get to this, it's probably already been out. It's probably been out for weeks by now. Jeez. But guys, if you do like what you have heard today, Emmanuel's albums are still on Amazon. How do I know that? Because I just bought them.
Are they on iTunes?
They're probably going to be on iTunes. You got an iPhone.
Yeah. I got a $2.81 check the other day.
Not bad, dude. Look at it.
Mm-hmm.
It's the gift that keeps on giving.
If you're wondering what I'm looking at on my phone, it's my bank account.
$2.82 richer. So, but yeah, guys, if you like what you hear, Emmanuel's music is still all over the internet, and you can still check it out. It is just as awesome as the day it came out. I can guarantee you that. And still beats a lot of the new music that's coming out here today. And if you like the podcast, you can check that out. That podcast is 100% on iTunes, and it's on Facebook, and it's on Stitcher, and it's on YouTube, and wherever you like to get podcasts, so you can check that out. Or you can check it out at SeanVersusWild.com. So yeah, guys, if you like what you hear, make sure to like, share, and subscribe, and support my man Brian Whiteman, dude. He's got to get a check for more than... I'm expecting a royalty check for more than $2.80.
We'll see $5.
Let's shoot for $5, guys. But yeah, this is part one, and stay tuned for part two of the Sean vs. Wild podcast.